This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. Without the crowds and fanfare and balloons, a virtual Democratic convention opened online Monday after the coronavirus pandemic forced the party to overhaul the convention, largely eliminating in-person gathering planned in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and turning it into a four-night event of 2 hours, prime-time packages of virtual speeches and events. Without the cheering crowds of a typical convention, organizers face a challenge in trying to build enthusiasm among supporters and the presumptive presidential nominee, former Vice President Joe Biden. U.S. President Donald Trump will be formally nominated for his second term at next week's Republican National Convention, which also has been scaled back due to coronavirus concerns. U.S. President Donald Trump said Monday he wants to speed up U.S. mail delivery, even as opposition Democrats are planning to vote this week to curb changes at the U.S. Postal Service. The Democrats say the changes would inhibit the processing of an expected sharp increase in mailed-in ballots in November's national presidential election. Mr. Trump told reporters Monday that he has encouraged officials to speed up the mail, not slow it down. He made the remarks outside the White House before leaving for campaign appearances in the Midwestern states of Minnesota and Wisconsin. Mr. Trump said last week that he opposes $28 billion in new funding for the postal agency. A part of it to pay for collection and processing of an expected onslaught of millions of mailed-in ballots from voters too afraid to go to polling places during the coronavirus pandemic. For months, Mr. Trump has claimed the states mailing out ballots to voters would lead to election fraud and a rigged vote against him. This is VOA News. Nearly 773,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally, with more than 170,000 of those deaths in the United States, more than 108 in Brazil. Mexico comes in third with about half of Brazil's figures. The number of infections is more than 21.8 million globally, with about a quarter of the infections in the U.S. and more than a quarter with Brazil and India combined. A new report says COVID-19 cases in U.S. nursing homes jumped nearly 80% earlier this summer, driven by rapid spread across the South and much of the West. Monday's report from the nursing home industry analyzed weekly coronavirus statistics reported to the government. Weekly cases in nursing homes rose 77% from a low point at the week starting June 21st to the week of July 26th. The Trump administration is trying to distribute fast coronavirus test machines to all nursing homes. Traffic came to a standstill in Buenos Aires Monday as hundreds of Argentines ventured out on foot and in their cars to protest against the government of President Alberto Fernandez. Protesters expressed a number of grievances against Fernandez's government, ranging from the state of the economy, lockdown measures across the country, and proposed judicial reform. Latin America's largest, or I should say third largest, economy. Deep crisis already before the pandemic hit. The United Nations data show the health crisis is now expected to shrink around 12% this year, driving millions into poverty and leaving almost 6 out of every 10 children and adolescents below the poverty line. Argentina's government has also launched a bid to reform the judiciary by increasing the number of federal courts, diluting the power of those that already exist in what critics have labeled an attempt to manipulate the court system. Groups of protesters set fires to tires in Khartoum Monday evening after Sudanese security forces fired tear gas to disperse thousands of protesters earlier in the day who gathered to mark the anniversary of a transitional power-sharing deal. The agreement set up a precarious alliance of civil technocrats and military officials following the April 2019 ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir, with elections due to be held after 39 months. The government says it is pushing ahead with reforms, but many people want swifter and deeper change. Police said in a statement that officers' use of tear gas during the demonstration was lawful and according to their evaluation of the situation on the ground, but has led to some random injuries. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa and the Voice of America, James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia's Chief Human Rights Commissioner says he plans to investigate possible human rights abuses.
It is true that several people have been arrested following a very violent protest, which led to the deaths of well over 100 people. The estimated number is around 9,000.
Zambia's president is criticized for saying his anti-corruption commission is planning a scheme to remove him from power. Turkey has reportedly brought more Syrian mercenaries to fight in Libya. And South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says his country has reached its coronavirus peak.
A ray of light is visible now on the horizon. Let us continue to stand united in our determination to defeat this virus.
Redesigning Gambia's capital for sustainability and COVID-19 further unravels Ghana's textile industry. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Commissioner of Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission says the overall human rights situation in Ethiopia has made a lot of progress in terms of opening up political and media spaces, as well as the repeal of some of the country's repressive laws. However, Daniel Bekele says Ethiopia still faces human rights challenges, some of which, he says, emanate from years of political crisis, often along ethnic and religious lines. Bekele's comments came in the wake of reports that Ethiopian authorities have detained dozens of opposition members and journalists, some without charges, following the June 29 killing of popular Oromo musician and activist Hachalu Hundessa. Bekele says his commission has launched an investigation into the violence and possible human rights abuses.
It is true that several people have been arrested following a very violent protest, which led to the deaths of well over 100 people and destruction of lots of property. The estimated number is around 9,000.
Can you confirm for us whether some of those arrested include the Oromo Federalist Congress leaders, the Jawar Mohammed, the Kelly Gerba, Eskinder Nega? Is it true that these people have been arrested?
Yes, the arrest included the leaders and members of some of the opposition groups, which includes from the Oromo Federalist Congress. It includes Jawar Mohammed, Bekele Gerba, and others. The third person you mentioned is Eskinder Nega, in a government response to the violent protests.
So, Dr. Bekele, has your organization had the opportunity to visit with those that have been detained?
Yes, we did. We probably have not covered all the detention centers, but we have visited several of them, including the ones in Addis where some of the high-profile detainees are being held at, and some of the detention facilities outside of the capital, Addis Ababa, as well.
Ethiopian authorities have reportedly said that the protesters have been acting on the orders of the Oromo Liberation Army in reaction to the killing of journalist Hachalu Hundessa.
Yeah, well, I do understand that the government in its preliminary investigation attributed the violence to an armed insurgency group known as the Oromo Liberation Army. But the underlying causes of the protest and the circumstances that led to the killing of the artist Hachalu Hundessa and the follow-up violence to that is still under investigation. And we will have to wait and see what the outcome of that investigation is like. But from the Human Rights Commission, we are undertaking an investigation into the violence and the types of human rights abuses that has happened in the context of the violent protest.
You were quoted last year, Dr. Bekele, saying that the human rights situation in Ethiopia was exacerbated due to mainly non-state actors. What would you say is the state of human rights now in Ethiopia, say under Prime Minister Abiy's government?
I mean, I would definitely say that overall human rights situation in Ethiopia has made a lot of positive progress over the last couple of years, both in terms of the opening up of political space and civic space. and the repeal of several of the repressive laws and the opening up of media space and political space and civic space in which private press and freedom of expression is thriving on. But be that as it may, this does not mean that there are no human rights problems, there are no human rights challenges, and there are no human rights issues. Indeed, actually, Ethiopia is facing a series of human rights challenges. Much of the human rights crisis is a problem that emanates from the political crisis of the country. So there's a lot of progress, but at the same time, a very complicated human rights crisis seems to persist. But at least it is fair to say that there is no policy of systemic human rights abuse being perpetrated by government as a matter of policy.
Daniel Bekele is the Chief Commissioner of Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission. He was speaking with us from Addis Ababa. Zambian President Edgar Lungu is coming under criticism after he was quoted as saying that the country's anti-corruption commission is planning a scheme to remove him from power. The Times of Zambia, a state-run newspaper, quoted the president as saying that the anti-graft agency is failing to go after corrupt public officials, but only concentrating on the plan for him to lose power. Supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front, the PF party, says the president was calling on the Anti-Corruption Commission to investigate allegations of corruption for all public officials. However, Charles Kakoma, the spokesperson for the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, tells viewers Peter Clotty that there should be zero tolerance when it comes to fighting corruption.
Our reaction is that the president is trying to send a message, a signal that his corrupt cabinet ministers and other senior government officials and the party officials are above the law. They cannot be touched. And this has been a consistent message from him, which has tended to undermine the fight against corruption. This is not the first time that he is issuing such a statement. The aim, of course, is to instill fear in the civil servants working under the Anti-Corruption Commission, not to arrest his ministers. The bottom line is that the corruption is being driven by officials in the ruling party, government officials, by ministers. And it's not by coincidence that those being arrested happen to be members of the ruling party and members of this cabinet.
His supporters are saying that the president has demonstrated his commitment in the fight against corruption and that his call was directly to the anti-corruption to go after people who are corrupt across the country. Isn't this acceptable to you?
He thinks that this corruption fight must be targeted at the opposition. That the people in the opposition are clean. They are not involved in corruption. So how can the Anti-Corruption Commission start arresting innocent people just because they are in the opposition? That is witch hunting. And the professional body like the Anti-Corruption Commission cannot start arresting people just because they are suspected to be in the opposition.
President Lungu has on record said those who are with him, who are engaged in acts of corruption, will not be protected, and that every person in public institutions who are engaged in acts of corruption will be dealt with. And that the call for the anti-corruption to work and target everybody who is engaged in the act of corruption is welcome. Shouldn't the UPND follow the president's lead by calling for anybody who is engaged in acts of corruption investigated and prosecuted?
Well, there's a lot of rhetoric coming from the president's mouth. He says one thing and does the opposite. And what we're seeing is that there's a lot of protection of such officials as well as government officials from being prosecuted by the Anti-Corruption Commission. And everybody is seeing that, and that is what is agitating people. Why is he protecting those that are corrupt? If he says everybody must be investigated and prosecuted if they are corrupt, that's why what should happen. But what is happening is that the corrupt party, ruling party officials and government officials are either not being investigated or the police are not taking action to arrest them. And when they are arrested, taken to court, the director of public prosecution is entering a nolle prosequi and is losing them. So that is what is annoying people.
That was Charles Kakoma, spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, UPND party. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. South Africa, with the continent's highest burden of COVID-19, has reached the peak of the pandemic, according to the president and top health officials. President Cyril Ramaphosa announced a loosening of restrictions, but said that he is not yet breathing a sigh of relief. Viewer's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg on how the nation reached this milestone.
A ray of hope for the Rainbow Nation, as the president announced that South Africa, with the continent's heaviest known burden of the coronavirus, has passed its viral peak since reporting its first cases in early March. President Cyril Ramaphosa, speaking late Saturday, said that over the past 3 weeks, the number of new confirmed cases has dropped from a daily average of about 12,000 to around 5,000 per day.
A ray of light is visible now on the horizon. Let us continue to exercise the greatest caution and care, and remain ever vigilant. Let us continue to stand united in our determination to defeat this virus.
On the streets of Johannesburg Monday, residents had mixed feelings about the news. Robert Etzinger said while he was happy that the restrictions have eased, he wants more.
I feel as though it's lagging on too long. You know, the rest of the economy needs to get back into the swing of things. The sooner we get over level two down to one, the sooner we can get the economy going and boost it again. That's my feeling.
The chair of South Africa's Advisory Committee on COVID-19, Dr. Salim Abdul Karim, credits the government's swift lockdown measures. He says the government gained about 6 to 8 weeks of precious time to prepare by declaring a state of disaster, closing schools, banning international travel, and banning the sales of alcohol and tobacco.
In the period where we are now just past the peak of the epidemic, we've been seeing a slowing down in the number of cases, so that we are now between 4,000 and 5,000 cases a day.
Ramaphosa also announced a loosening of restrictions, including allowing sales of tobacco and alcohol.
And guided by the advice of our health experts, the Medical Advisory Committee, and after consultation with provincial and local government, Cabinet has decided to place the entire country on alert level 2. With effect from midnight on Monday, the 17th of August, 2020.
South Africa has at least 600,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the nation of nearly 60 million people. It is also at the forefront of coronavirus prevention, with scientists at the University of the Witwatersrand this week launching the nation's second vaccine trial. Karim says the nation's long history with other pandemics has prepared it for this challenge.
South Africa was able to build its capacity to undertake testing because of its TB and HIV epidemics. It's the same technology. The problem has been in South Africa that we can't buy enough test kits because we are trying to buy the same test kits everyone else is trying to buy. And so we were constrained for a substantial period in just not being able to get enough kits. As that solution has been, as that problem has been solved, now we do have enough kits. We have been able to escalate our testing to around 40 to 50,000 tests per day.
The COVID-19 peak may have passed, says Karim, but the danger of a second surge remains. To that end, he urges South Africans to remain cautious. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 18th. Arab media are reporting that Turkey has brought more Syrian mercenaries to fight in Libya. The spokesperson for the Eastern Libyan Military Command, General Khalid Haftar, claims that many of the mercenaries are terrorists who will destabilize the country. Edward Urania reports from Cairo.
A Syrian mercenary complains on Libyan TV that he has not been paid in months as forces loyal to Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar accuse Turkey of importing more mercenaries to regions held by the rival Tripoli government. Haftar spokesman Colonel Khalid Mahjoub says Turkey is flouting an embargo passed by the UN Security Council. He says that around 3,000 Syrian mercenaries, some of them Islamic State militants engaged in various types of terrorism, have been brought to Libya recently, ignoring a UN Security Council resolution. Rami Abdulrahman, who heads the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, told Arab media that Turkey may have brought in around 10,000 mercenaries, defying the international community. He says that Turkey and those Syrian militias aligned with it continue to recruit mercenaries from camps inside the opposition enclave of Idlib, some from extremist or terrorist groups that have ties to Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State group. Turkey has not responded to these latest accusations. The country has periodically denied sending mercenaries to Libya, but acknowledged that it is trying to help the government in Tripoli. Tripoli-based Libyan Foreign Minister Mohammed Taha Siala, in a joint press conference with visiting German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas, accused Eastern Military Commander General Haftar of importing mercenaries to help his own forces. He says that mercenaries are being brought in by land, sea, and air to fight the Tripoli-based unity government from Libya's border with Egypt in defiance of UN resolutions. Tripoli government Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj has accused General Haftar in the past of using mercenaries from Sudan and the Russian-based Wagner group. Egypt's parliament also authorized the country's military to intervene in Libya if Egyptian security came under threat. But it is not clear if any Egyptian forces are currently fighting inside Libya. German Foreign Minister Maas told journalists Monday that the world must not be fooled by the deceptive calm in Libya, and that he was meeting with Tripoli-based officials to try and talk about ways out of this very dangerous situation. Maas also called on General Haftar's side to reopen closed oil ports, which he says cost the Libyan treasury around $8 billion. Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar and Qatari Defense Minister Khalid Al-Attiyah also met with Tripoli officials separately. Qatari-owned Al Jazeera TV reported that the officials discussed security and military agreements, along with a maritime oil and gas exploration deal between Turkey and Tripoli. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
An urban development project is looking at how Gambia's capital city, Banjul, can be designed more sustainably. The two-year study, financed by the African Development Bank and implemented by the Gambian government and the United Nations Office for Project Services, is aiming to implement a design that can better equip the city to address environmental conservation, economic development, public services, and social inclusion. UNOP's senior project manager, Agathe Nungaret, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the project.
Social inclusion in urban development is making sure that the city works for everyone. And so we're looking at different groups in the city that might not have access to the same resources in the city than others. We're talking about public services, infrastructure, sometimes economic resources, education. So that's very wide. The city historically has been designed around the needs of the dominant groups. And of course, men are part of dominant groups. To give you an example, some women are have different transport needs than men, because men, they go from periphery to center because most of their transport needs are around commuting for work. But a lot of women who are not employed in the formal sector, their transport really goes from periphery to periphery, maybe to get the kids to school, maybe to go shopping for groceries, maybe to get water if you don't have tap water at home. And we noticed that most of the organized formal public transport doesn't really respond to the needs of women because they focus on moving from the periphery to the center.
Can you also tell me about economic disparity?
What we have noticed is that for lower income residents, public space is really an economic asset. This is where you are going to conduct your business. And so how does public space work for the most vulnerable residents? It's very important for the plans for Greater Banjul 2014. We also want to make sure that land is something that everyone has access to. Because if you own land, if you can control land, then that gives you a collateral to get a loan, to develop your business.
How much is it also, was the city planning affected by when it was first originated that, you know, Gambia was a colony of the United Kingdom? What kind of resources or design techniques, any, are being introduced that are more Gambian or homegrown rather than a city that was kind of built by or for the colonial power structure?
So the historic city of Banjul was definitely created based on colonial urban design principles. But we see that it's not really matching the way Gambians live and work. We see, for example, in the center of Banjul, you don't have any outdoor space that Gambians can use. And we see that it's very important for Gambian families to have an outdoor space to perform some daily activities such as cooking or growing a vegetable garden. And so this is some kind of urban design principle that we have to include in the future development plans to make sure that the new way the city is going to develop matches the cultural needs of the residents.
That was Agathe Nugaret, a senior project manager at the United Nations Office for Project Services. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak. Manufacturers of Ghana's iconic fabrics have come under increasing pressure as counterfeits made in China undercut local production. COVID-19 and the resulting steep decline in sales has added more woes to this industry. Producers are hoping that measures aimed at stopping the counterfeits will turn things around. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Ghana has a rich history of textile production, making different fabrics from woven kente to brightly colored batik to wax prints where designs carry meanings. Consumers will often buy new fabrics to mark occasions, like funerals. However, counterfeits have severely impacted batik producer Esther Amate's business. About 15 years ago, she started seeing counterfeit batik in Ghana with lower prices driven by consumer demand. While she makes the batik fabric she sells in her store in Accra, she also sells counterfeit wax prints. But now, she says, COVID-19 has underscored the importance of supporting local industries, so she has vowed to stop selling Chinese imports.
When people started demanding what they wanted, then I said, okay, I'm a businesswoman, so I have to go in that way too. But now I want to stop. Now we need a lot of support so that we can stop and do our own thing. Because we can do very nice fabrics.
Wax print textile company GTP has designed and printed fabrics in Ghana since 1966. Their print designs are often stolen, printed in China and other Asian nations, and then smuggled back into Ghana, severely undercutting the business. It is also very hard to tell the real fabrics from the fakes, GTP's marketing director, Stephen Kofi Beidou, says.
It's highly, highly frustrating, very frustrating, and sometimes it's really worrying, not just for us, but also for the country, because I can tell you, the tech African print market is one of the, it's a very huge market. But unfortunately for us, our government do not get the necessary revenues that it's supposed to get because of the huge amount of smuggling.
COVID-19 compounded these issues. During the recent lockdown in Ghana, sales dropped from about 1 million yards a month to less than 100,000. However, sales are slowly recovering and GTP remains hopeful. It even brought out new designs inspired by Ghana's handling of the pandemic, with prints to represent the president's addresses to the nation and to reflect lockdown measures. But Beidou says he will not be surprised if these two are soon counterfeited. GTP does have measures in place to protect its products. In 2015, it started working with Ghanaian company M Pedigree, which uses technology to help buyers know what they purchase is authentic. The fabrics have a scratch code on them, which buyers text to a number to get confirmation the fabric is from GTP. Eugene Kwaku-Pwadu is Director of Corporate Affairs at M Pedigree.
The revolutionary aspect about the technology is how it arms not the regulatory systems per se or the government alone, but more importantly consumers, makes consumers the vanguards against fake, counterfeit or spurious products, in this case textiles.
For the past few years, Ghana's government has been considering measures to regulate the industry and curb illegal imports, such as creating a stamp for fabrics produced in Ghana and a task force to look for counterfeit goods. GTP's Beidou hopes that legislation to enact these measures will be introduced next year. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
And that's it for this Tuesday, August 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Abbott in Washington, hoping that you will have a great day.